Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been very thoughtful about and indeed involved in helping the rest of us assess various phases of this war for the free world from his vantage point in Paris, France, is our first guest. His name is Michel Gerfinkel. He is the founder and president of Colloquium, an important Paris-based think tank, also an editorialist with Valeur Actuelle, for which he has been for quite some time the editor-in-chief. He is a contributor to American public policy debates as well, notably in publications like the Middle East Quarterly, Commentary PJ Media, The Wall Street Journal, and Mosaic. It's a great pleasure to say welcome back to a good friend of this program and of mine, Michel Gerfinkel. Welcome, sir. It's good to have you with us again.
My pleasure.
There's a number of things that I'm anxious to talk with you about, Michel. Let's start with one that's sort of top of mind. As we speak, the Quad group known, the title given to an informal consortium of the United States, Japan, Australia, and India, is in the process of holding a summit, and they'll be talking, among other things, I'm quite sure, about a decision made by the Australians, together with the United States and Great Britain, to depart from a planned acquisition of French-built submarines in order to purchase instead American-designed and British-assisted nuclear-powered submarines. The French government has expressed enormous outrage at this decision and is said to be working with others in Europe to sort of retaliate in some fashion, at the minimum by building, you know, a more European-centric defense capability and effort. This has been a long-term French agenda item, of course, but talk us through this decision as you see it, Michel, and the fallout from it in France and perhaps beyond.
I would like to say first and foremost that the global geopolitical context has tremendously changed in the world and especially in Southeast Asia. Over the past years, we have been witnessing a new assertiveness on the part of the Chinese, which is, in fact, turning into a very aggressive stance. And I must say that lots of people in the world are talking now of China as the major challenge, the major disruptive force in global geopolitics, and as the major threat to the established world order. The COVID-19 crisis in particular has been quite revealing in many ways, since the Chinese did not quite cooperate with the world institutions and with the Western countries in terms of warning about the disease and taking the appropriate steps when the disease was spreading in China proper.
I would say moreover, that's putting it mildly, yes.
Yes, and moreover, the Chinese took an incredibly arrogant stand in the first months of the disease, saying more or less that they were now the most efficient country in the world in terms of pharmaceutics and in terms of providing medical material for every country in the world. And also, they said that their way of controlling populations and getting an accurate image of what people do and how they interact should be taken by the rest of the world as a model for disease monitoring.
Specifically, this very repressive locking down of large populations and areas of the country. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. The Chinese have their own tradition of strategics that goes back to a famous thinker called Sun Tzu, was probably a general in one of the Chinese armies a few centuries before the Christian era. And Sun Tzu famously said that armies should not get into any battle until the battle is already won, which means that as long as you are not a complete victor, don't show that you already are in possession of a superior force. And what,
or perhaps you're even at war, for that matter, right? Conceal what you're up to.
And what is striking is that the present president of China, Mr. Xi Jinping, did exactly the opposite. He boasted about Chinese supremacy at a moment when that kind of supremacy was clearly underway, but had not been completely established. And this is a major strategic blunder according to Chinese strategic thinking. So we can be quite amazed by the behavior of the Chinese. But what is difficult to deny is that there is now very clearly something like a Chinese threat all over the world, but especially, of course, in the Far East, in Southeast Asia, and in Oceania. And I believe that the Australians had a global strategic outlook and were eager to develop their naval capacities, and this is the reason why they did such an important contract with France. All of a sudden, the Australians realized that, in fact, they were facing a much more difficult situation, and they had to come closer with their direct Pacific neighbors like the Americans, and also perhaps with their former mother country, England, to develop an independent naval force in order to deter any kind of Chinese aggression. It's very clear that it was done in a rather brutal way. The dealing with the French was not exactly gentlemanlike. Now, the French themselves, when what they thought was their interest was concerned, did not refrain from acting in a similar way. Let me just, for instance, point to the fact that 50 years ago or so, the French interrupted in a very brutal way their military cooperation with the State of Israel. The State of Israel had funded and bought quite a lot of very important weapons in order to ensure its military capacities. And General de Gaulle, in right after the Six Days War of 1967, decreed an embargo on Israel, which in fact was depriving Israel of any long-term means of defending itself. So the French may, under certain circumstances, be as cynical as the Australians have been towards the French. And the big question is whether some kind of broader strategic thinking will help reconcile the interest of France with the interest of the Quad nations, Australia, United States, India, against the Chinese threat.
This is a very thoughtful and fulsome explanation of the background here, and I think you're right, that would be a very constructive outcome if it can be achieved. In the meantime, though, it seems as though the French, in their upset, shall we say, have been lashing out and making threats, at least, if not actual aggressive diplomatic and other efforts to punish, well, arguably, you know, these allies, the United States, Britain, notably, and to some extent as well, Australia, specifically in Europe. Are you seeing evidence of that, Michel? And if so, how does that square with what you were describing as what would be a much more constructive response to all of this?
Empty words, because this is the 21st century. You need a very large market to develop a defense industry. The French have very important capacity, but they cannot do it alone. They have to do it in partnership with other countries. In fact, there is a very important military partnership between France and the United States on a lot of production lines. Now, of course, the most immediate partners of France should be the European countries. But who are the European countries? You have only two countries with the economic and the industrial capacity to engage into an important defense effort. And these countries are, on the one hand, England, Britain, but Britain now goes with the Americans, as we see, for instance, in the case of the new pact with Australia and the United States, and or Germany. But Germany, while interested up to a point in cooperating with the French, Germany, nonetheless, is also at least equally interested into keeping a strong relationship with the United States. So the French may say that they will retaliate, but this is a kind of retaliation that will lead them nowhere, because they, in fact, need cooperation with the United States. They need cooperation with a lot of countries just in order to sustain a modicum of independence or autonomy with their own defense industry.
This is a most thoughtful, you know, assessment of the situation, Michel. And as they say, from your lips to God's ears, I hope that the French government and its allies, both in Europe and here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, will indeed set aside this unpleasantness, find ways of collaborating, because there are so few of us left, especially in terms of free world nations that have significant military capabilities, and the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party is so grave that we really can't afford these kinds of fractures, especially as they are certain to be exploited by the Chinese wherever possible. Which brings me to an important new report from a French Ministry of Defense research institute at the École Militaire, the military school of the French Army. It's entitled Influence Operations of the Chinese and Machiavellian moment. It's some 650, 700 pages long, Michelle. I don't want you to comment in detail on it, but it does strike me as an effort, a serious effort, clearly, by the French defense establishment to reckon with a piece of the problem with the Chinese, going back to what you were saying earlier about Sun Tzu and his strategy for using non-military instruments to achieve victory before using military ones, you know, to decisive advantage. This is part of course, what the Chinese communists have called their unrestricted warfare strategy in contemporary era. Talk about what France is currently thinking about the Chinese, and in particular, the extent to which France itself, as well as Europe more broadly, is being subjected to these insidious, subversive, and ultimately potentially mortally dangerous influence operations.
I mean, such a report cannot be published overnight, clearly. And I've tried to look at this report. I'm aware of its global assessments, and really, it's a very impressive piece of work. In other terms, it has certainly taken several years for the French to work on the issue and to collect quite an important number of files of quite deep information and a lot of very in-depth analysis just in order to bring about such a report. That means that the French have been very clearly aware now for many years of the implications of the rise of China. And I must tell you that 10 years ago, there has been a debate, an ongoing debate that that had been made public in France about Chinese students in France. For many years, the French were very happy to see a lot of Chinese students coming to France, learning French, and being part of the academic life in this country, until it was realized that most Chinese students were not real students, that what they did was, in fact, to spend their entire semesters at college, at the university, to simply Xerox every bit of information they can gather from the French universities, from the French laboratories. You see, in France, big part, fundamental research is done by state-controlled and state-run universities and academic institutions. So there is no clear border between civilian research and research that can have military application as well. We know very, very clearly that a lot of what the Chinese have achieved in terms of technology, and they have achieved a lot, was based on simply theft. I mean, they simply
stealing.
They were able,
in other words,
steal.
Yeah.
Yes. To steal Western to a very large extent Western technology. Let me give you one example which is very striking. China today is the country with the largest high-speed train network. There are about, I believe, 20 high-speed railways lines in China. And some of these lines are very impressive because they simply go straight from one part of the country to another part. When China started to develop the high-speed train technology, in fact, they made a contract with the French, who were the leaders in that technology. And the French were very happy to do a joint venture with the Chinese and to build together with the Chinese a first high-speed line. I think it was between Peking, Beijing, and Tianjin, on a few hundred kilometers away from Beijing. And but once that was achieved, the French were expecting more contracts to be agreed upon. But the Chinese did, no, thank you. Now we have developed our own technology and we can build our own high-speed lines. The truth, of course.
And we can sell them to the French, among others, I suspect, in due course as well.
That's a very interesting question indeed. But as the French realized, there was no new Chinese technology developed by the Chinese. The Chinese simply stole the French technology. And in many, many fields, that's about the same. So I think the French are very much aware of the Chinese threat. The French are willing to cooperate with America, with the United States, to counter that threat. President Macron repeatedly hinted to his willingness to cooperate with the United States, and I hope, I would be distressed if this is not the case, but I hope that given this context, there will be ways to go beyond the present crisis between the French on the one hand, the Australians, the British, and the Americans on the other hand.
Well, again, this is a very hopeful analysis, and I think obviously very thoughtful and realistic in terms of the assessment of the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to all of us. It is not, I'm afraid, shared widely elsewhere in Europe. We've witnessed the Chinese moving there as they have around the world, including, I'm sorry to say, inside the United States as well, to penetrate and obtain strategic capabilities, both technologies and in some cases, you know, infrastructure arrangements, the Belt and Road Initiative in particular, and ports across Europe that they now dominate, that we are told in a lot of quarters translates into a degree of integration with the Chinese Communist Party, Michelle, that makes the kind of clear-eyed view of the threat it poses to all of us more and more difficult, let alone responding appropriately to it. But you are a very wise and thoughtful observer of this scene. And I look forward to talking on another occasion with you soon, I hope, more about this analysis from the French Ministry of Defense about the Chinese unrestricted warfare influence operations against France and the rest of us, for that matter, as well as to talk with you further about a topic on which you are also deeply expert and have been very clear-eyed for as long as I've known you, namely the threat posed to France specifically, but the rest of us, by what I think of as Sharia supremacism, especially in the wake of the strategic victory that the Taliban has achieved, I'm sorry to say, at the hands of Joe Biden in this country. So we'll return to all of that with you in the near future. In the meantime, my friend, thank you so much for your very important insights today and for sharing them with us so generously. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak to one of our other leaders on such matters, former congressman, now former ambassador, Pete Hoekstra.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. As the leaders of the United States, Japan, India, and Australia confer today as members of the Quad, they will presumably be preoccupied with the principal threat all four countries face. That would be the Chinese Communist Party's increasingly operationalized aspiration for world domination. The Quad's meeting will be taking place, however, under the oppressive shadow of Joe Biden's humiliating strategic defeat in Afghanistan. After all, their common enemy is not only the principal beneficiary of that debacle. Communist China has clearly been further emboldened by it. Unfortunately, so have the victorious Taliban and other jihadists worldwide, since they continue, pursuant to Islam's Sharia doctrine, to wage endless war against us infidels. The Quad must reject Team Biden's dangerous delusion that what is left of the free world can safely do business with either so-called moderate jihadists or their Chinese communist friends. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The power to tax is the power to destroy, wrote John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was born this day, September 24th, 1755. No one had a greater impact on constitutional law in America, as he served on the bench 34 years and helped write over 1,000 decisions. He fought in the Revolution under Washington and during the winter at Valley Forge. The nation felt a profound loss at his death. The Liberty Bell cracked while tolling at his funeral. Chief Justice John Marshall wrote, "It would be strange indeed if with such a people, our institutions did not presuppose Christianity and did not often refer to it."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is a man of great distinction, having served in a number of important capacities for our government, notably as a member of the House of Representatives from Michigan for quite a number of years, including distinguished service as both the chairman and the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. He went on to become the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, and now is in the exalted position, I'm delighted to say, as chairman of the advisory board of the Center for Security Policy, which of course makes this program possible. His name is Pete Hoekstra. We call him Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ambassador, Your Grace, and always our friend, Pete. It's good to have you with us again, sir. Thank you so much for taking some time.
Frank, I'm eager to talk with you. You had a great lineup of topics that we just discussed, and let's get started.
Good. Well, it starts with your new and very important piece, an issue that I think has to be top of mind for all of us. And as I was just discussing with our first guest, Michelle Garfinkel, should be very much in the mix in the Quad meeting that is taking place as we speak. As this program airs, it will be in the rearview mirror, of course. But Pete, at the Gatestone Institute, you've talked about the war with the, well, I call them Sharia supremacists, is not over. In fact, whatever we think the outcome of it in Afghanistan, tell us a bit about your thinking on why that's so and its implications.
You know, Frank, I was listening to the president speak earlier this week to the UN, and it was kind of in the background, and I was paying some attention, but not clearly focused in. And when he got done, I went out and did something else, and then I came back. I said, I think he said that we were no longer at war, that he's the first president to address the UN when America's not at war, and. And I said, I got to go back. And it was painful. I listened to it again. And the disappointing thing was that it was at the 32-minute mark of a 33-minute speech where the president said, we weren't at war. And it's like, that's not right. And so I decided to write this piece. And I concluded with saying the president can say whatever he wants, but that doesn't mean he's right. We were defeated in Afghanistan. We left there in defeat. The jihadists attacked us. They killed 13 American service people. They killed hundreds of Afghans. This war is not over. And I was at a seminar last night, and I listened to Shannon Spann, and she is the wife of our first casualty in Afghanistan. And she was also a CIA analyst. And she said, I asked her if I could steal the phrase. I'm not that bright, but I know when to steal stuff that's good. And she said, go ahead, use it. Because, you know, what she said, what happened, where we are right now is a little history. When the Taliban defeated the Russians, they went out and they created this mythology through terrorist groups across the world that they had defeated the Russians, and that the defeat of Russia in Afghanistan ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And she said, you know, that can then be directly traced to the attacks on our embassies in Africa, the USS Cole, and those types of things. And she says, they're creating the same mythology right now. We've defeated America in Afghanistan, and this is really the kickoff to taking down America. They are emboldened. They are not celebrating. Well, they are celebrating, but they're not celebrating that it's over. You know, victory in Afghanistan is just one small step to taking down America, and they believe that they're on the path to get there.
You know, my only quibble about all of that, Pete, is that it's not mythology. They did defeat, with our help, the Mujahideen, the Russians in their day, the Soviet Union. And unfortunately, thanks to Joe Biden, they did defeat us. So they've created a narrative, maybe, but it's not a myth. The point, though, that you're making, which I think is absolutely indisputable, is that they are emboldened by it. Not just the Taliban, not just the people that are now once again back in business in a safe haven called Afghanistan, whether that's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or ISIS-K or the Haqqani Network or heavens knows how many others, but they are part of a global enterprise. They call it the Global Islamic Movement, I believe. And it includes not just, of course, the various Sunni kinds of jihadists or Sharia supremacists, is the way I think of it, but also the Shia ones under Iran's sponsorship principally. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. And Pete, as you look at all of these characters, how do you reckon, emboldened as they are, their capacity to wage a redoubled jihad against both this country and Western civilization, or Christendom, if you will, more generally, lines up now with their ambitions?
Well, they're more motivated than they ever have been. Okay, they're energized. Hey, we're on the way to victory. They are better equipped than they have ever been. I mean, we left them, you know, okay, yeah. Are they going to take a Humvee into New York City? No. But can they go in there with night vision goggles and other sophisticated equipment that we left behind? Small arms, you know, machine gun, you know, all the equipment that we left behind? Yes. Are they better trained in the use of that equipment? Yes. You know, the Afghan army, many of them who are going to, you know, yeah, it's disrespectful to the Afghans, but the phrase that I frequently heard when I visited there is, you know, you rent an Afghan, you don't own one. So I'm sure that many of them have flipped sides and are now engaged, you know, with the Taliban and terrorist organizations after they've been trained by Americans on the use of our equipment. And the final thing is, America is as weak and invulnerable as we've been in a long time. When we were attacked in, you know, in 2001, at least the world still respected us. Today, you know, our allies are looking at us. Those who are trying to say, hey, which side are we going to be on? Can we line up with the Americans? What they're looking at is they're looking at thousands of our allies left behind in Afghanistan. And as Shannon was saying last night, and others who are very familiar with what's going on in the ground right now, the people that we left behind, Afghanistan is hell for them right now. And the media is ignoring it. And President Biden is doing nothing. These people are being terrorized. They are being slaughtered. But it's not in front of our eyes. But just because, again, just because we're not seeing it doesn't mean it's not happening.
Biden and his team. I mean, who knows what Biden actually is at the moment, but the team, whoever is president of the United States or acting in that capacity, is actually worse than doing nothing. They are actively promoting this idea that, as a professor at George Washington put it in an important op-ed the other day, they're actually pretending that there is such a thing as moderate jihadists and that we can safely do business with them. We can not only relinquish Afghanistan to them, the territory, we can leave behind all those arms, we can provide foreign aid to them and legitimacy, international recognition, but we can do similar things, perhaps, with other jihadists in other parts of the world that we just as soon not be involved in. And Iran obviously comes top of mind in that regard. Pete, you've been watching this kind of process for a long time. Is there any such thing as a moderate jihadist? And what are the repercussions of pretending that is the case?
Well, we saw this play out again under many of these same people. Maybe they were at lower levels with President Obama. Egypt, Libya, Syria, ISIS, you know, they thought they could work with these guys. They're wrong. The president's speech again at the UN, because these speeches, remember, speech writers go over every word of these speeches. They don't put in throwaway lines. But the president was talking, we will have diplomacy. We will talk to everyone. Trump talked to North Korea. He talked to the Taliban. But he also came in with a strong hand saying, you mess with me, you're dead. Biden goes in and says, we'll talk to you and we'll go in with a weak hand, kind of like we did with the Iran negotiation, for the Iran deal. Kind of what we did
and are
in
doing
Afghanistan.
Now, for that matter.
Yeah, right. That we're doing now. And so he believes we can use diplomacy to do this. And we saw what happened in 2009 and 10, the first few years. Remember the catastrophe of ISIS. They, under Obama, they actually created a caliphate where they governed a huge geographic area in Syria and Iraq. That's what you get from believing you can negotiate with these people as moderates and you can work with them. You get chaos, you get defeat, and you get an enemy that is 10 times worse. The old phrase, you give them an inch, they take a mile. This is the radical jihadist, and we are giving them miles and miles, and they are going to take much, much more.
We're talking with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, former Congressman Pete Hoekstra, former chairman of the House Armed Intelligence Committee, as well as former ambassador to the Netherlands, about a piece that he's written at the Gatestone Institute entitled, "We May Have Left Afghanistan, Mr. President, But We Are Still at War." And just to close this out, Pete, I want to turn to another topic with you here in a moment, but just to close this out, is there any doubt in your mind from both your study of these jihadis, as well as, your close monitoring over many years of U.S. government policy and intelligence community, insights, that we're dealing with people who have as their, they think, Allah-directed mandate, conquest of the entire world, and that they are under an obligation, according to Sharia, to engage in violent jihad until they accomplish that outcome. And therefore, that war continues, you're absolutely right, and if anything, it can only intensify as they believe their victory is approaching and they become more capable of waging this jihad, not just again in Afghanistan or from Afghanistan, but truly globally.
No, absolutely. I mean, take a look at who they are. The numbers that they've killed of our allies, and our own troops, it's a huge number. But take a look at the number of Muslims that they've killed, fellow members of the faith, but who they consider apostates, right? Hundreds of thousands of these. They see themselves.
And that's just in Afghanistan.
And then Iraq, right? They see themselves as protectors of their faith. Number one, against apostates of their own faith, and then the infidels. So that's their number one, protect the faith. And then it is to carry out the mission or the vision of the faith, which is a global caliphate. And, you know, so yes, this is far from over. And it is intended to be a global conquest, not limited to Afghanistan. It's not limited to Iraq. It's not limited to the, you know, purging the apostates within their own faith in the countries where, you know, Islam is the predominant religion. It is back to the expansion. And, you know, I also wrote in the article, this is a difficult discussion. Okay, talking as Christians and others to talk about another faith. And this is the discussion we avoided for basically much of the last 18 years by calling this a war on terror. It's not a war on terror. That's the tactic. This is a war against radical Islam. And you and I have been accused of being Islamophobes by the allies of these groups because we dare reference that these jihadist groups may be motivated by a religion. And you know what? They are. I'm not afraid to say it. You're not afraid to say it. I'm willing to admit that they, you know, that they perverted their faith and those types of things. Cause I've met lots of Muslims who have been good people to me. They protected me when I've been over there, and those types of things, but their motivation comes from their interpretation of their religion.
Yeah. Well, Sharia, I think, is basically the point. It's kind of the operating code of authoritative Islam, and you're absolutely right, Congressman. Fortunately for us, not all Muslims adhere to it, nor want to live under it, let alone impose it on the rest of the world. But unfortunately, the authorities of their faith say that is the true faith and that is their duty as faithful Muslims. And that's what makes this so toxic. But I can't stress adequately how important what you just said is, that we have been blinded, I would argue, not just 18 years, but 20 years, at least since 9/11, if not before, to this reality, in part because we wound up having our government under the sway of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has made a point of telling us what we can say, what we can think, what we can know about Islam and its Sharia doctrine. And that has, I think, as you said so well, contributed to not just a lot of loss of life and immense loss of treasure over the years, and most recently the loss of Afghanistan, but a very perilous future, especially if the Biden team has its way in terms of working with the so-called moderate jihadists. We'll be returning to this topic, I know, with you soon, but let me turn to another, because as we're speaking, this conversation is taking place among four important nations, all of whom I hope are concerned about that jihad piece, to be sure, but also have come together under this rubric of the Quad to contend with the mortal threat posed to all of them, and indeed, I believe, the free world more generally, by the Chinese Communist Party. At the moment, Pete, where do you think this loose alliance stands? Have each of these nations really begun to come to grips with the magnitude of the challenge the Chinese Communist Party represents? Or is it uneven, well, arguably, most especially with respect to President Biden and his team?
No, we have not come to grips with it. We need, again, go back to what the president said at the UN. Did he challenge China? Did he challenge China on their role in weaponizing the pandemic, the Wuhan pandemic, against the world? We need to start calling it the Wuhan pandemic. This came from the Chinese. You know, did he call,
I call it
into
the CCP
account?
Virus myself, to be honest.
Okay.
He didn't even mention the word China, in fact.
No, you know, did he, you know, the genocide, Frank, you know, we've said China's engaged in genocide. Okay. They are killing their own people. They are harvesting organs. You know, look at what they've done in Hong Kong, and then take a look at the economic chaos that they are trying to create around the world. No, the United States is, hey, we're going to handle this through diplomacy. You know, it is scary that we are unwilling to confront the Chinese. And again, some of our, you know, some of our allies, I mean, Australia has been phenomenal. They've been going after it. But, you know, again, they can't do anything without U.S. leadership. And, you know, so no, it and it, from my perspective right now, it all begins with COVID. And, you know, if we don't start holding China accountable for COVID, and I believe they didn't intentionally release the virus, but once it was released, they saw that this could be a good thing for them in terms of them achieving their global objectives. But, you know, this then becomes, you know, they then become empowered the next time, whether it's a cyber attack, whether it's another pandemic or whatever, they'll say, you know what? We can use this and the rest of the world will do nothing. No, we have not confronted it.
This is part of the problem. And I think what you've kind of touched on, which is so important, and we did with Michelle a moment ago, is the unrestricted warfare doctrine that underlies how the Chinese are approaching the four countries of the Quad, Japan, Australia, India, and us, and the world more generally, as you've indicated, Pete, it's economic warfare, it's political warfare, it's influence operations. There's a major new study, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but we talked a little bit about it with Michelle, out of the Defense Ministry of France, going into these influence operations that the Chinese are engaged in, 650-some pages long, detailing this at great length, and I think hopefully considerable value to us as well as to the French. But one thing I wanted to ask you about, Pete, because you've spent time overseas, notably in Europe, you're familiar, among other things, with what the Chinese have been doing to build out there, as well as in Africa, as well as in South and Central Asia, as well as in the Far East, as well as in our own hemisphere, Latin America, and, well, arguably our own country. This so-called Belt and Road Initiative. Could you talk a little bit about what that means, both in terms of sort of a colonial empire infrastructure, but also power projection capabilities that can greatly enhance their ability to realize this ambition to dominate the planet, much as the Islamists seek to do?
Right. Well, you got, I think you brought up 2 points, one of which is their influence campaigns. You know, my contacts in Europe told me more than a year and a half ago that the Chinese had created an influence operation specifically to control the message on COVID, on the CCP virus. And, you know, we saw it. The Lancet, the magazine, the medical journal, the WHO, all of these were, you know, saying, you know, it developed naturally, you know, they couldn't have developed in the lab, all supporting the Chinese narrative. A year and a half later, we found out that almost all of those things were lies. Well, how do they happen? They happen because these organizations fell under the rubric of the Chinese influence operation. You know, and hallelujah, Trump, you know, President Trump got us out of the WHO. They were a puppet for the Chinese. Biden goes back in. We're crazy.
Boasting about it at the UN.
My language. Boasting about it at the UN. We're back in. And, you know, and then you go to this whole Belt and Road Initiative, which is another effort by the Chinese. So let's say you're a small country and you live on the coast and you have a facilities that, or you have an area that could make a great port. The Chinese come in and say, hey, we'll build your port out. And this poor country and their corrupt leadership say, yeah, okay. So they come in with billions of dollars, build the port. The leaders of these countries walk away with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars themselves. And then they sign, you know, generous financing terms or agreements with the Chinese that these leaders from both China and that country know that they'll never meet. And when they don't, when they fail to meet the terms, then these things become the prop fall under control of the Chinese. And
they wind up taking over, you know, these assets that they have built on this the basis of these loans. And Pete, you saw this up close and personal, I know, in some of those major ports in Europe are now essentially controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, if not, you know, owned by them in every respect. They're managed by them. And to what extent, Pete, again, you've spent much of your professional life working with the intelligence agencies. To what extent does all of that translate into not just influence, not just, you know, perhaps power projection capabilities or the ability to deny our power projection? You know, if we have to reinforce Europe, what does it mean that those ports are not available? But also, to what extent does this also provide an infrastructure for intelligence operations by the Chinese?
Oh, yeah. No, if you control, you know, and this has happened primarily along the southern border of Europe. You know, this happens in Greece. This happens in Italy. It's also been happening somewhat in Spain. But hey, if you control, you know, these ports, you know, you have some influence in who has priority in terms of getting into the port. You see everything that goes in and out of these ports. You know, it's a huge, you know, and then, yeah, like you said, it's from these bases, it becomes a power projection. You control the major port in Greece. You have a footprint to see much of southern Europe. Yeah. And if you've got Spain, Italy, and Greece, you've got the southern tier of Europe.
We have to leave it at that. I just did want to commend to our audience once again a really fascinating report that our Committee on the Present Danger China has done on this issue. It's called China's Dream, the World's Nightmare. And you can find it at presentdangerchina.org. We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you so much for this extended visit today. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And in the meantime, congratulations on the important new piece at the Gatestone Institute. I hope everybody will check it out. Thank you. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The power to tax is the power to destroy, wrote John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was born this day, September 24th, 1755. No one had a greater impact on constitutional law in America, as he served on the bench 34 years and helped write over 1,000 decisions. He fought in the Revolution under Washington, enduring the winter at Valley Forge. The nation felt a profound loss at his death. The Liberty Bell cracked while tolling at his funeral. Chief Justice John Marshall wrote, "It would be strange indeed if with such a people, our institutions did not presuppose Christianity and did not often refer to it."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.